How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Chapter 1 of Tom Clark and His Wife, The Rosicrucian Story. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Kirk Ziegler. Tom Clark and His Wife, The Rosicrucian Story, by P.B. Randolph. The Man. He used to pace rapidly up and down the deck for a minute or two, and then, suddenly, striking his forehead, as if a new thought were just painfully coming into being at the major foci of his soul, he would throw himself prone upon one of the after-seats of the old Uncle Sam, the steamer in which we were going from San Francisco to Panama, and there he would lie, apparently musing and evidently enjoying some sort of interior life. But whether that life was one of reverie, dream, or disembodiedness was a mystery to us all, and would have remained so, but that on being asked, he very complacently satisfied our doubts by informing us that on such occasion he, in spirit, visited a place not laid down in ordinary charts, and the name of which was the realm of Wotcher Gifterno, which means in English Violinist's Meadow, very like Fiddler's Green. When not pacing the deck or reclining, or gazing at the glorious sunsets on the sea, or the still more gorgeous sunrisings on the mountains, he was in the habit of catching flies, which flies he would forthwith proceed to dissect and examine by means of a microscope constructed of a drop of water in a bent broom wisp. Gradually the man became quite a favorite with both passengers and officers of the ship, and not a day passed but a crowd of ladies and gentlemen would gather round him to listen to the stories he would not merely recite, but compose as he went along, each one containing a moral of more than ordinary significance. It was apparent from the first that the man was some sort of a mystic, a dreamer, or some such out of the ordinary style of person, because everything he said or did bore an unmistakable ghostly impress. He was sorrowful withal, at times, and yet no one on the ship had a greater or more humorous flow of spirits. In the midst, however, of his brightest sallies, he would suddenly stop short, as if at that moment his listening soul had caught the jubilant cry of angels when God had just pardoned some sinful, storm-tossed human soul. One day, during the progress of a long and interesting conversation on the nature of that mysterious thing called the human soul, and in which our fellow passenger had, as usual, taken a leading part, with the endeavor to elicit, as well as impart, information, he suddenly changed color, turned almost deathly pale, and for full 5 minutes, perhaps more, looked straight into the sky, as if gazing upon the awful and ineffable mysteries of that weird phantom land which intuition demonstrates, but cold reason utterly rejects or challenges for tangible proof. Long and steadily gazed the man, and then he shuddered as if he had just received some fearful solution of the problem near his heart. And I shuddered also, in pure sympathy with what I could not fairly understand. At length he spoke, but with bated breath, and in tones so low, so deep, so solemn, that it seemed as though a dead, and not a living man, gave utterance to the sounds. "Laura! Laura! Ah, lovely! Would that I had gone then! That I were with thee now!" And he relapsed into silence. Surprised both at his abruptness, change of manner and theme, for 10 minutes before, and despite the solemnity of the conversational topic, he had been at a fever heat of run and hilarity. I asked him what he meant. Accustomed as we had been to hear him break in upon the most grave and dolorous talk with a droll observation which instantly provoked the most unrestrainable, hilarious mirth. Used as we had been to hear him perpetrate a joke, and set us all in a roar in the very midst of some heart-moving tale of woe, whereat our eyes had moistened, and our pulses throbbed tumultuously, yet I was not, even by all this, prepared for the singular characteristic now presented. In reply to my question, he first wiped away an involuntary tear, as if ashamed of his weakness, then raised his head and exclaimed, "Laura! Laura! The beautiful one!" "What of her?" asked Colbert, who sat opposite him, and who was deeply moved by his evident distress, and whose curiosity, as that of us all, was deeply piqued. "Listen," said he, "and I will tell you." And then, while we eagerly drank in his words and strove to drink in their strange and wondrous meaning, first warning us that what he was about to say was but the text of something to be thereafter told, he leaned back upon the taffrail, and while the steamer gently ploughed her way toward Acapulco and far off Panama, said, "Fleshless yet living, I strode through the grand old hall of a mighty temple. I had been compelled to climb the hills to reach the wall that bars the gates of glory, and now within my heart strange pulses beat the while. I found myself upon the verge of a vast extended plain, stretching out to the infinitudes, as it seemed, through the narrow spaces wherein the vision was not obstructed by certain dense, convolving vapor clouds that ever and anon rose from off the murky breast of the waters of the river of Lethe, that rolled hard by and skirted the immense prairie on and over which I proposed to travel, on my way from minus to plus, from nothing to something, from bad to good, and from better to best, traveling toward my unknown, unimagined destiny, traveling from the now toward the shall be. And I stood and mutely gazed at the dense, dark shadows rolling murkily, massily over the plain and through the spaces, dim shadows of dead worlds. No sound, no footfall, not even my own, not an echo broke the stillness. I was alone, alone upon the vast solitude, the tremendous wastes of an unknown, mysterious, unimagined etern, unimagined in all its fearful stillitude. Within my bosom there was a heart, but no pulse went from it bounding through my veins. No throb beat back responsive life to my feeling, listening spirit. I and my soul were there alone. We only, the thinking self, and the self that ever knows, but never thinks, were there. My heart was not cold, yet it was more. It was, I felt, changed to solid stone. Changed all save one small point, distant, afar off, like unto the vague ghost of a long-forgotten fancy, and this seemed to have been the penalty inflicted for things done by me while on the earth, for it appeared that I was dead, and that my soul had begun an almost endless pilgrimage. To what? To where? A penalty! And yet no black memory of red-handed crime haunted me, or lurked in the intricacies of the mystic wards of my death-defying soul. And I strode all alone adown the uncolumned vistas of the grand old temple, a temple whose walls were builded of flown seconds, whose tessellated pavements were laid in sheeted hours, whose windows on one side opened upon the gone ages, and on the other upon the yet-to-be, and its sublime turrets pierced the clouds, which roll over and mantle the hoary summits of the gray mountains of time. And so I and my soul walked through this temple by ourselves, alone. With clear, keen gaze, I looked forth upon the vastness, and my vision swept over the floors of all the dead years, yet in vain, for the things of my longing were not there. I beheld trees, but all their leaves were motionless, and no caroling bird sent its heart's notes forth to waken the dim solitudes into life and music, which are love. There were stately groves beneath the arching span of the temple's massy dome, but no amphion strains of melody fell on the ear, or filled the spaces, from their myriad moveless branches, or from out their fair theatres. All was still. It was a palace of frozen tones, and only the music of silence, which is vocal, if we listen well, prevailed. And I, Pascal the Thinker, and my thought, strange, uncouth, yet mighty but moveless thought, were the only living things beneath the expansive dome. Living, I had sacrificed all things, health, riches, honor, fame, ease, even love itself, for thought and by thought had overtopped many who had started on the race for glory long ere my soul had awakened to a consciousness of itself, which means power. In life I had, so it seemed, builded stronger than I thought, and had reached a mental eminence, occupied a throne so lofty that mankind wondered, stood aloof, and gazed at me from afar off, and by reason of my thought had gathered from me, and thus condemned the thinker to an utter solitude, even in the most thronged and busy haunts of men. And I walked through earth's most crowded cities more lonely than the hermit of the desert, whose eyes are never gladdened by the sight of human form, and through the chambers of whose brain no human voice goes ringing. Thus it was on earth, and now that I had quitted it for ever, with undaunted soul, strong purpose, and fearless tread, assured of an endless immortality, and had entered upon the life of thinking, still was I alone. Had my life, my thinking, and my action on thought been failures? The contemplation of such a possibility was bitter, very bitter, even like unto painful death. And yet it seemed true that failure had been mine. Failure, notwithstanding men by thousands spoke well of me and of my works, the children of my thought, and bought my books in thousands. Failure? My soul rejected the idea in utter loathing. For a moment the social spirit, the heartness of my nature, overshadowed reason, and caused me to forget that, even though confined by dungeon walls, stricken with poverty, deformity, sin or disease, even though left out to freeze in the cold world's spite, yet the thinker is ever the world's true and only king. I had become, for a moment, oblivious of the fact that failure was an impossibility. Rosicrucians never fail. But now, as I slowly moved along, I felt my human nature was at war with the God nature within, and that heart for a while was holding the head in duress. I longed for release from solitude. My humanity yearned for association, and would have there, on the breast of the great Etern, given worlds for the company of the lowliest soul I had ever beheld, and despised, as I walked the streets of the cities of the far-off earth. I yearned for human society and affection, and could even have found blissful solace with a dog, just such a dog as, in times past, I had scornfully kicked in Cairo and Stamboul. Even a dog was denied me now, all affection withheld from me, and in the terrible presence of its absence I longed for death, forgetting again that soul can never die. I longed for that deeper extinguishment which should sweep the soul from being, and crown it with limitless eternal night, forgetful, again that the memories of soul must live, though the rememberer cease to be, and that hence horrors would echo through the universe, children mourning for their suicidal parent, and that parent myself. And I lay me down beneath a tree in despair, a tree which stood out all alone from its fellows in a grove hard by, a tree all ragged and lightning-scathed, an awful monument, mute yet eloquently proclaiming to the wondering onlooker that God had passed that way in fierce, deific wrath once upon a time, in the dead ages, whose ashes now bestrewed the floors of the mighty temple of Eterne. It was dreadful, very dreadful, to be all alone. True, the pangs of hunger, the tortures of thirst, the fires of ambition, and the raging flames of earthly passion no longer marred my peace. Pain, such as mortals feel, was unknown. No disease racked my frame, or disturbed the serenity of my external being, for I was immortal, and could laugh all these and death itself to scorn. And yet a keener anguish, a more fearful suffering, was mine. I wept, and my cries gave back no outer sound, but they rang in somber echoes through the mighty arches, the bottomless caverns, the abysmal depths of soul, my soul, racking it with torment such as only thinking things can feel. Such is the lot, such the discipline of the destined citizens of the farther Empyrean, a region known only to the brethren of the temple of peerless Rosicrucia. Sleep came, sweet sleep, deep and strange, and in it I dreamed. Methought I still wandered gloomily beneath the vast arches of the grand old hall, until at last, after countless cycles of ripe years had been gathered back into the treasury of the Ender Supreme, I stood before a solid, massive door, which an inscription there above announced as being the entrance to the Garden of the Beatitudes. This door was secured by 1,000 locks, besides one larger than all the rest combined. Every one of these locks might be opened, but the opener could not pass through unless he unfastened the master lock, having 10,000 bolts and wards. Once more despair seized on my soul, in this dream which was not at all a dream, for to achieve an entrance through the gate without the master key was a task, so said the inscription, that would defy the labors of human armies for periods of time, utterly defying man's comprehension. So many were the difficulties, so vastly strong the bolts. Sadly, mournfully, I turned away, when, as if by chance, forgetting that there was no such thing as chance, my eye encountered a rivetless space upon the solid brazen door, a circular space, around the periphery of which was an inscription running thus: Man only fails through feebleness of will. Within this smooth circle was the semblance of a golden triangle, embracing a crystalline globe, winged and beautiful, crowned with a Rosicrucian cipher, while beneath it stood out, in fiery characters, the single word, Tri. The very instant I caught the magic significance of these divine inscriptions, a new hope was begotten in my soul. Despair fled from me, and I passed into a dream within a dream. What a change! During my slumber it seemed that I had been transported to the summit of a very lofty mountain, yet still within the temple. By my side stood an aged and saintly man, of regal and majestic presence. He was clad in oriental garb of the long-gone ages, and his flowing robes were bound to his waist by a golden band, wrought into the similitude of a shining serpent, the sacred emblem of eternal wisdom. Around his broad and lofty brow was a coronet of silver, dusted with spiculi of finest diamond. On the sides of the center were two scarabi, the symbol of immortality, and between them was a pyramid, on which was inscribed a mystical character which told, at the same time, that his name was Ramus the Great. This royal personage spake kindly to me, and his soft tones fell upon hearing of my soul like words of pardon to the sense of sinners at the judgment seat. "Look, my son," said he, at the same time pointing toward a vast procession of the newly risen dead, a spectral army on the sides of the mountain, slowly, steadily, mournfully wending their way toward the part of the temple I had quitted previous to the commencement of this dream within a dream. Said the man at my side, "Yonder host of pilgrims are men and women who are seeking, as thou hast sought, to unbar the gates of glory, that they may pass through them into the delightful garden of the Beatitudes. It is one thing to be endowed with intellectual strength, knowledge, and immortality. It is another to be wise and happy. The first is a boon granted to all the children of earth alike. The last can only be attained by integral development, by self-endeavor, by innate goodness and godness continually manifested, and this in material and aromal worlds alike. Man is man and woman is woman, wherever they may be. The true way to the garden lies not through manifestation corridor, but through the hall of silence, and each aspirant must open the door for himself alone. Failing to enter, as thou hast failed, each must turn back, and, like thee, come hither to mount retrospect, and entering into the labyrinth within its sides, must search for the triple key, which alone can unbar the gate, and admit to the beautiful garden. Remember, despair not. Try, and in an instant the phantom man turned from me, and with outstretched arms and benignance beaming from every feature, hied him toward the ascending army. Again I stood alone, not now in despondency and gloom, but in all the serene strength of noble, conscious manhood, not the actual, but the certain and glorious possibility thereof. My soul had grown. It was aware of all its past shortcomings, failures, and its hatreds toward two men who had done me deadly wrong. This feeling still survived, stronger than ever, now that I was across the Bridge of Hours, and had become a citizen of the inner land, a wanderer through eternity. That hate was as immortal as my deathless soul. Will it ever be? And yet I had ever meant well. All was calm in my spirit, save this single awful thing. In this spirit, with this consciousness, not of deep malignance, but of outraged justice, I began to look for the mysterious key. And as I looked, an instinct told me that the key must consist of certain grand human virtues and corresponding good deeds, held and done before I left the shores of time and embarked upon the strange and mystic sea whereon my soul's fortunes were now cast. And so I searched, and at last seemed to have found what I sought. And thereupon I wished myself once more before the brazen gate. Instantly, as if by magic, the wish was realized, and I stood before it, on the same spot formerly occupied. The first inscription, the symbols and circle had disappeared, and in their stead was another circle, containing these lines. Speak, for thou shalt be heard. Tell what thou hast done to elevate thy fellow men, and to round out the angles of thy own soul. Whom hast thou uplifted, loved, hated? Speak, and when the words containing the key are spoken, the door will yield, and thou mayest pass the threshold. The writing slowly faded, and left naught but a surface, but that surface as of molten gold. I spoke aloud my claim to entrance, and, to my astonishment, my voice rang out shrill and clear, through the vaults and arches of the mighty dome towering far above my head. I have suffered from infancy, been opposed from the cradle to maturity, been hated, robbed, slandered on all sides, yet pushed forward in defiance of all, until I reached all that I desired, all that earth could give me. Self-educated, I achieved triumphs where others failed, have reaped laurels and grasped the keys of fame, and laughed at my folly afterwards, because what is fame? A canker, gnawing out one's life when living, disturbing his repose when dead, not worth a straw. But in all this, despite the ending, I have set an example, by following which man might elevate himself, society be improved, and its constituents realize the bliss of moving in loftier spheres of usefulness. While giving voice to these truths, I firmly expected to see the gate fly open at their conclusion. But what was my horror and dismay to see that it moved not at all, while the echoes of my speech gave back in frightfully resonant waves of sound the last word, usefulness. Not being able to think of any nobler achievements, I cast my eyes groundward, and on again raising them, I beheld across the clear space on the door the single word, try. Taking heart again, I said, alone I sought the secret of restoring health to the sick, and gave it freely to the world, without money, without price. I have made grand efforts to banish sloth, sin, ignorance, have ever upheld the honor of the cross, and the sweet religion it symbolizes, striving ever to upraise the veil that hides man from himself. In the effort I have been misapprehended, my motives impugned, and my reward has been poverty, slander, disgrace. In the strife I have been heedless to every call save that of human duty, and in obeying the behest of a nobler destiny, have been regardless of all worldly distinction, have ignored wealth, fame, honorable place in the world's esteem, and even been deaf to the calls of love. I ceased, and again the vault threw back my last word, and all the arches echoed, love. The gate moved not, but once more appeared upon the golden lozenge on the door the word, try, in greater brightness than before, while it seemed to the hearing sense of my spirit that a thousand velvet whispers, low, so low, gently cadence back, love. I have rebuked the immoral, humbled the lofty and overbearing, exposed deception, comforted the mourner, redeemed the harlot, reformed the thief, fed the orphan, and upheld the rights and dignity of labor. Still the door moved not, but again the echoes gave back the last word, labor. I have preached immortality to thousands, and prevailed on them to believe it, have written of, and everywhere proclaimed its mighty truths. I have beaten the skeptic, confirmed the wavering, reassured the doubting, and through long and bitter years, in both hemispheres of the globe, have declared that if a man die, he shall live again, thus endeavoring to overthrow error, establish truth, banish superstition, and on their ruins lay the deep and broad foundations of a better faith. As if a myriad voices chimed out my last syllable, there rang through the spacious halls and corridors of the temple the sublime word, faith, and instantly the bolts appeared to move within their iron wards. Continuing, I said, I have ever endeavored, save in one single instance, to foster, and in all cases have a spirit of forgiveness. This time there was no mistake. The thousand bolts flew back. The ponderous brazen gate moved forward and back, like a vast curtain, as if swayed by a gentle wind, while a million silvery voices sang gloriously, in all cases have a spirit of forgiveness. Joyously I tried again, intuition plainly telling me that only one thing more was necessary to end my lonely pilgrimage, and exalt me to the blessed companionship of the dear ones whom I so longed to join their glory walks adown the celestial glades and vistas of God's garden of the Beatitudes. I spoke again. I have fallen from man's esteem in pursuance of what appeared to be my duty. A new faith sprung up in the land, and unwise zealots brought shame and bitter reproach against and upon it. Lured by false reasoning, I yielded to the fascinations of a specious sophistry, and for a while my soul languished under the iron bondage of a powerful and glittering falsehood. At length, seeing my errors, I strove to correct them, and to sift the chaff from the true and solid grain. But the people refused to believe me honest, and did not, would not, understand me. But they insisted that in denouncing error, I ignored the living truths of God's great economy. Yet still I labored on, trying to correct my faults, and to cultivate the queen of human virtues, charity. Scarcely had this last word escaped my lips than the massive portals flew wide open, disclosing to my enraptured gaze such a sight of supernal and celestial beauty, grandeur and magnificence, as human language is totally inadequate to describe. For it was such as it stood there revealed before my ravished soul, and I may not here reveal the wondrous things I saw and heard. Laura, Laura, my beautiful one, the dear dead maiden of the long agone, stood before me, just within the lines of paradise. She loved me still. I, the dear maiden of my youth, had not forgotten the lover of her early and her earthly days. When I was a boy, and she was a girl, in the city by the sea, ere the cruel death had snatched her from my arms, and love, a long, long time ago, for the love of the Indian, as his hatred survives the grave. And she said, Pascal, my beloved, lone student of the weary world, I await thy entrance here. But thou mayest not enter now, because no hatred can live inside these gates of bliss. Wear it out, discard it. Thou art yet incomplete. Thy work is still unfinished. Thou hast found the keys. Go back to earth and give them to thy fellow men. Teach, first thyself, and then thy brethren, that usefulness, love, labor, forgiveness, faith and charity are the only keys which are potent to cure all ill, and unbar the gates of glory. Laura, beautiful Laura, I obey thee. Wait for me, love, I am coming soon, I cried, as she slowly retreated, and the gate closed again. Not yet, not yet, I cried, as with extended arms I implored the beauteous vision to remain but a single instant longer. But she was gone. I fell to the ground in a swoon. When I woke again, I found the night had grown 2 hours older than it was when I sat down in the chair in my little chamber in Bush Street, the little chamber which I occupied in the goodly city of the Golden Gate. Thus spake the Rosicrucian. We were all deeply moved at the recital, and one after the other we retired to our rooms, pondering on the story and its splendid moral. Next day we reached Acapulco, and not till we had left and were far on our way toward Panama did we have an opportunity of listening to the sermon to the eloquent text I have just recounted. At length he gave it, as nearly as it can possibly be reproduced, in the following words. End of chapter 1. Chapter 2 of Tom Clark and His Wife, The Rosicrucian Story, by P. B. Randolph. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Double Dream, Part 1. At length he gave it, as nearly as it can possibly be reproduced, in the following words, and saw within the moonlight of his room an angel writing in a book of gold. Leigh Hunt. And so you like the text, do you? Very well. I will now see how much better you will be pleased with the sermon. Listen. I cannot and will not stand this any longer. Here am I, yet a young man, in the very prime and heyday of life, and I do believe that I shall be a regular corpse in less than no time, if a change for the better don't very soon take place in my family. That's just as certain as open and shut. She is killing me by inches, the vampire. Would that I had been 35 million of miles on the other side of nowhere the day I married her. Don't I, though? Betsy Clark is killing me. No love, no kindness, not a soft look, never a gentle smile. Oh, don't I wish somebody's funeral was over, but not mine, for I feel quite capable of loving, of being happy yet, and of making somebody's daughter happy likewise. People may well say that marriage is a lottery, a great lottery. For if there's one thing surer than another, then it is perfectly certain that I have drawn the very tallest kind of a blank. And hang me, if it wasn't for the disgrace of the thing, if I wouldn't run off and hitch myself for life to one of the Hottentots I have read about. For anything would be better than this misery, long strung out. Oh, don't I wish I was a Turk! When a fellow's a Turk, he can have ever so many wives, and strangle all of 'em that don't suit him or come to ta, as they ought to. Bully for the Turks! I wish I knew how to turn myself into one. If I did, I'd be the biggest kind of Mohammedan afore morning. Such was the substance of about the 1,000th soliloquy on the same subject, to the same purport, delivered by Mr. Thomas W. Clark, during the last 7 years of his wedded life. The gentleman named delivered himself of the contented and philanthropic speech just recited, on the morning of a fine day, just after the usual morning meal, and quarrelled with his wife, du jour. Female attendant would better express the relation de facto. Mr. Clark was not yet aware that a woman is ever just what her husband's conduct makes her, a thing that some husbands besides himself have yet to learn. Every day this couple's food was seasoned with sundry and divers sorts of condiments other than those in the castor. There was a great deal of pickle from his side of the gay and festive board, in the shape of jealous, spiteful innuendos, and from her side much delicate sauce piquante, in the form of sweet allusions to a former husband, whom she declared to have been the very best husband that was ever sent to a premature grave by a vixen, she might have added, truthfully, but did not, finishing the sentence with, "to be loved by a tender, gentle wife like her." The lady had gotten bravely over all her amiable weaknesses long ago. Gentle! What are tigresses? Tender! What is a virago? So far the man. Now for his mate. Scarcely had her lord, Mr. Thomas W., as she was wont to call him, gone out of the house, and slammed the door behind him, at the same time giving vent to the last bottleful of spleen distilled and concocted in his soul, than Mrs. Thomas W., or poor Betsy Clark, as I prefer to call her, for she was truly, really pitiable, for more reasons than one, but mainly because she had common sense and would not exercise it sufficiently to make the best of a bad bargain, threw herself upon the bed, where she cried a little, and raved a good deal, to the self-same tune as of yore. Getting tired of both these delightful occupations very soon, she varied them by striking an attitude before a portrait of the dear defunct, badly executed, the portrait, not the man, whose name she bore when she became Mistress Thomas W. This picture of a former husband Tom Clark had not had courage or sense enough to put his foot through, but did have bad taste sufficient to permit to hang up in the very room where he lived and ate, and where its beauties were duly and daily expatiated upon, and the virtues of its original lauded to the skies, of course to the intense delight of Mr. Clark. Madam had a tongue, a regular patent, venom-mounted, back-spring and double-action tongue, and, what is more, knew well how to use it when it was fit on, which, to do her justice, was not more than 23 hours and a half each day. Never did an opportunity offer that she did not avail herself to amplify the merits of the deceased, especially in presence of such visitors as chance or business brought to their house, all to the especial delectation of her living spouse, Mr. Thomas W. Clark. Just look at her now. There she is, kneeling at her shrine, my Lady Gay, vehemently pouring forth the recital of her wrongs, forgetful of any one else's, as usual with the genus grumbler, dropping tears and maledictions, now on her own folly, then on the devoted head of him she had promised to love, honor, and obey, Mr. Clark, fruit grower, farmer, and horse dealer. Exhausted at length, She winds up the dramatic scene by invoking all the blessings of all the saints in all the calendars on the soul of him whose counterfeit presentment hangs there upon the wall. If this couple did not absolutely hate each other, they came so near it that a Philadelphia lawyer would have been puzzled to tell the other from which, and yet nobody but themselves had the least idea of the real state of things. Those undercurrents of married life that only occasionally breach through and extensively display themselves in the presence of third parties. In the very nature of the case, how absurd it is for outsiders to presume to know the real status of affairs, to comprehend the actual facts which exist behind the curtains of every or any married couple in the land. Hymen is a fellow fond of wearing all sorts of masks and disguises, and it often happens that tons of salt exist where people suppose nothing but sugar and lollipops are to be found. Tom and his wife, the latter especially, pretended to a vast deal of loving-kindness. Oh, how great, toward each other, and they were wise, in the presence of other people. You would have thought, had you seen them billing and cooing like a pair of turtle doves, to quote the bard of Baldwinsville, that there never was so true, so perfect a union as their own, and would not have entertained the shadow of a doubt but they had been expressly formed for each other from the foundations of the world, if not before. No sooner did they meet, before folks, even after the most trifling absence, than they mutually fell to kissing and endearing like two swains just mated, all which made the fools wonder, but wise people to grieve. Physical manifestations are not quite love's methods, and it is a safe rule that those who most ape love externally have less of it within. And in private, so great a difference there is between behind and before, in these matters of the heart, billing and cooing before folks acts as a nauseant upon sensible men and women, and in this case it did upon a few of the better class of the city of Santa Blarneo, within a few miles of which Clark lived. Betsy Clark gave a last, long, lingering look at the portrait, saying the while, "Don't I wish you were alive and back here again, my love, my darling, my precious duck?" Lucky for him was it that such could not be, for had it been possible and actualized, he would have been finely plucked, not to say roasted, stewed, perpetually broiled, and in every way done brown. If you were here, I should be happy, because you was a man. But this one, meaning Tom, bah! And the lady bounced upon her feet and kicked the cat by way of emphasis. She resumed, "I can't stand it, and I won't. There, that's flat. I'm still young, and people of sense tell me I am handsome, at least good-looking. I am certain the glass does, and no doubt there are plenty who would gladly link their lot with mine if he was only dead." And she shuddered as the fearful thought had birth. "Dead! I wish he was, and true as I live, I've a great good mind to accomplish my wish." And again she shuddered. Poor woman! She was indeed tempted of the devil. As the horrible suggestion flashed across the sea of her soul, it illumined many a deep, chasmal abyss, of whose existence, up to that moment, she had been utterly unaware. The human soul is a fearful thing, especially when it stands bare before the eternal eye, with myriad snake forms, its own abnormal creation, writhing round and near it. A fearful thing, and Betsy Clark trembled in the ghastly presence of uncommitted murder, whose glance of lurid flame set fire to her heart, and scorched and seared it with consuming heat. Its flashful light lasted but for a moment, but even that was a world too long, for it illumined all the dark caverns of her soul, and disclosed to the horrified gaze of an aerial being which that instant chanced to pass that way, an abysmal deep of crime possibility, so dense, black and terrible, that it almost shriveled the eyeballs and shrouded the vision of the peerless citizen of the upper courts of glory. Suddenly the radiant heaven-born ceased its flight through the azure, looked pityingly earth and heavenward, heaved a deep sigh and soul-drawn sigh, and stayed a while to gaze upon the woman and the man. Long it gazed, at first in sorrow, but presently a smile passed across its face, as if a new and good thought had struck it, and then it darted off into space, as if intent upon discovering a cure for the desperate state of things just witnessed. Did it succeed? Wait a while and see. Human nature is a very curious and remarkable institution. So is woman nature, only a great deal more so, especially that of the California persuasion. Still, it was not a little singular that Tom's wife's mind should have engendered, of hate and impatience, the precise thought that agitated his own at the very minute, that very identical crime thought which had just rushed into being from the deeps of his own spirit, twin monsters, symbolating murder, in both their ears. There is as close a sympathy between opposites and antagonists, indeed far greater, than between similarities, as strong attractions between opposing souls as in those fashioned in the same mold. True, this affirmation antagonizes many notions among current philosophies and philosophers, but it is true, notwithstanding, and therefore so much the worse for the philosophers. The same fearful thought troubled two souls at the same time, and each determined to do a little private killing on their own individual and separate accounts. As yet, however, only the intent existed. The plans were yet crude, vague, immature, and only the crime loomed up indistinctly, like a grim, black mountain through a wintry fog. The day grew older by 12 hours, but when the sunset came, 10 years had fastened themselves upon the brows of both the woman and the man since last they had parted at rosy morn. Bad thoughts are famous for making men grow old before the weight of years has borne them earthward. They wrinkle the brow and bring on decrepitude, senility and gray hairs faster than time himself can possibly whirl bodies graveward. The rolling hours and circling years are less swift than evil thoughts of evil doing. Right doing, innocence, and well-wishing make us young. Bad thoughts rob us of youth, vivacity, and manhood. Let us turn to Mr. and Mrs. Thomas W. Night was on the mountain, darkness in the valley, and only stars could guide them now in the doubtful rally. There was a star hung out in the sky, and she had already determined to watch their destinies, with what success and in what manner, will be apparent before finishing my story, every word of which is true in one sense, if not precisely in another. The sun had set, and slowly the moon was uprising. Blessed moon! God's left eye, wherewith he at night overlooketh the thoughts and deeds of solitary men and solitary women, for only such are capable of crime, those only who are, and live alone, and many such there be, even at their own firesides, surrounded by their own families, own flesh, own blood, fathers, mothers, wives, as times go, husbands, as they are conventionally called. Many there be who exist in dreadful solitudes in the very midst of human crowds, who live alone and pass through life from the cradle to the grave, perfect strangers, perfect hermits, wholly unknowing, totally unknown, like interlopers on the globe, whose very right to be here all the world disputes. Friends, I have seen many such, have you? These lonely people, these exotics, these insulars in the busy haunts of men, the teeming hives of commerce, alone in earth's well-paced market towns, in the very Saturnalia of trade's gala days. And they are to be pitied, because they all have human, yearning hearts, filled to the brim with great strangling sorrows, and they have high and holy aspirations, only that the world chokes them down, crushes out the pure, sweet life God gave them. These are the unloved ones, yet ought not to be, for are they not somebody's sons and daughters? Yes, then they have rights, and the first, greatest, highest right of all is the right of being loved, loved by the people of the land, our world cousins, for what we do, are doing, or have done, and to be loved for the sake of the dear soul within, by somebody else's son or daughter. So we think of the Rosicrucian order, so one day we'll think the world. At this point of the Rosicrucian's narrative, Captain Jones, one of his auditory, interrupted him with, "Why, I thought the Rosicrucian system had been dead, buried, and forgotten 2 centuries ago." He replied, "The false or pseudo-Rosicrucian system has ceased to be. Truth herself is deathless. I cannot now stop to explain what interests you concerning the revived system of Rosicrucianism. You will now please to allow me to proceed with my story," said he, and then resumed saying, "I repeat that only those who live alone, unloved, unloving, are they who, becoming morbid, having all their kindly feelings driven back upon themselves, daily, hourly eating up their own hearts, brooding over their wrongs, their social and other misfortunes, at length engender crime, if not against their fellow men, then against themselves. Oh, for something to love, and be loved by, if but a little pet dog. The unloved are ever wrecked, the unloving ever wreck others. It is sweet to be loved by even a dumb brute. But ah, how inexpressibly, how infinitely better to be endeared for yourself alone, for your integral wealth of soul, by a man, a full true man, by a woman, a full gushing-hearted woman, or sweeter, dearer still, a child, some glorious hero of a hobby horse, some kitten torturing Cora. Ah, what a chord to touch! I am very fond of children, dear little godlings of the ages. Those who reciprocate affection truly are too full of God to keep a devil's lodging-house. It is a dear thing to feel the great truth, one of Rosicrucius' truths, that nothing is more certain than that somewhere, perhaps on earth, perhaps in some one of the innumerable aromal worlds, star spangles on God's diadem, or from amidst the mournful monodes in material creation, someone loves us, and that there goeth up a prayer, sweet-toned as seraphs, to him for you, my weary brother, for you, my sister of the dark locks turning prematurely gray, for all of us whose paths through life have been thickly strewn with thorns and rocks, sharp boulders and deep and frightful pitfalls, great threatening, yawning gulfs. Oh, the little birds sing east, and the little birds sing west, toll slowly, and I smile to think God's greatness flows around our incompleteness, round our restlessness his rest. Somebody loves us for ourselves' sake. Thank God for that. And the pale, silver shield of the moon hangs out in the radiant blue, and myriad gods look down, through starry eyes, upon this little world, as it floats, a tiny bubble, on space's vast ocean. And they speak through their eyes, and bid us all love the Supreme, by loving one another. And they say, love much. Such is the whole duty of man. The moon, God's night eye, takes note of all ye do, and is sometimes forced to withdraw behind cloud veils, that ye may not behold her sweet features while she weeps at the sad spectacle of thy wrongdoing. Luna, gentle Luna, does not like to peer down into human souls, and there behold the slimy badness, which will ere long breed deeds of horror to make her lovely face more pale. Things which disfigure the gardens of man's spirit, and transform them into tangled brakes, where only weeds and unsightly things do grow. and Luna has a recording angel sitting on her shield, whose duty is to flash all intelligence up to his deific brain, in whose service she hath ever been. He is just, inexorably just, ever rewarding as man sinneth or obeys. And so it is poor policy to sin by night. It is equally so to sin by day, for then the sun, God's right eye, fails not to behold you, for he is always shining, and his rays pierce the clouds and light up the world, even though thick fogs and dense vapors conceal his radiant countenance from some. He sees man, though man beholds him not, and he photographs all human thoughts and deeds upon the very substance of the soul, and that too, so well and deeply, that nothing will destroy the picture. No sophistical, all right, lavements can wash it away. No philosophic bath destroy it. They are indelible, these sun pictures on the spirit, and they are, some of them, very unsightly things to hang in the grand memory galleries of the imperishable human soul. For in the coming epochs of existence, as man moves down the corridors of time, these pictures will still hang upon the walls, and, if evil, will peer down sadly and reproachfully, and fright many a joy away, when man would fain be rid, but cannot, of pain-provoking recollections, when his body shall be stranded on the shores of the grave, and his spirit is being wafted over strange and mystic seas on the farther brink of time. Night had come down, and Mr. and Mrs. Thomas W. retired to bed, each with thoughts of murder rankling in their hearts. Not a word was spoken, but they lay with throbbing pulses, gazing out upon the night, through a little window at the foot of the bed, whose upper sash was down, gazing out upon the starry lamps that skirt the highways of the sky, beacons of safety placed there to recall and guide all stray and wandering souls back on their way to heaven. And they silently looked at the stars as they twinkled and shimmered in the azure. The stars shone, and strange, horrible, ghastly thoughts agitated the woman and the man. Tom might get sick, and he might die. Isn't it possible to feed him with a little arsenic, or some other sort of poison, and not get caught at it? I think it is. He, once dead, I shall be free. Free as the air, and happy as the birds. Happy! Think of it! Is it not possible to push Betsy over the cliff, accidentally, of course, and thus rid myself of her and misery together, and forever? Forever! Picture it! And thus they lay as the night wore on, two precious immortal souls, with rank murder for a bedfellow. At the end of an hour's cogitation, both had reached the desperate resolution to carry their wishes into execution and attempt the fearful crime. Come down in thy profoundest gloom, without one radiant firefly's light, beneath the ebon arch and tomb. Earth from the gaze of heaven, O night, a deed of darkness must be done. Put out the moon, roll back the sun. Betsy was to season Tom's coffee. He was very fond of coffee. Tom was to treat Betsy to a ride in the one-horse shay, and topple the shay, horse, and Mrs. Thomas W., all except his mother's only son, over a most convenient and inviting little precipice, a trifle over 400 feet deep, with boulders at the bottom rather thicker than the autumn leaves in Vallombrosa, and a good deal harder. All this was to be the result of an accident and inscrutable providence, as a matter of course. Afterwards he was to buy a slashing suit of mourning, bury what was left of her in grand style, erect a fine headstone of marble announcing that the Lord gave and the Lord took away, blessed be the name of the Lord, an inscription many a spouse would like to read in their own cases. The proposed locality of the fall of woman luckily lay right on the road between their house and Santa Blarneo. Each thought, I may not be able to achieve the exploit upon which I am bent, but one thing is certain, which is that it shall not fail for want of trying. Once fairly accomplished, freedom comes, and then for a high old time. So thought the woman, so thought the man. Night has various and strange influences, which are altogether unknown to the day. The Magi, on the plains of Chaldea, the astrologers of early Egypt, and the whole ancient world duly acknowledge the power of the astral bodies. The whole interest of Bulwer's Zenoni hinges on the soul-expanding potentiality of a star upon Clarence Glyndon, one of the heroes of that Rosicrucian story. Indeed, the whole august fraternity, from the neophyte of last week to Ross and Henry Moore, down to Apollonius of Tyanai, and away through the ages to Thothmes, and down beyond all the Egyptian dynasties to Zytos, and still away into the very heart of the pre-Adamite eras, we know, held strange doctrines concerning stars, and if the historian of the order, the great Mirandolo, be not mistaken, our brotherhood possesses the key that reveals the nature of the starry influences, and how they may be gained. Of my own knowledge, for I am in the fifth degree, therefore do not know all these mysteries. There are destinies in the stars. Well, on this particular night, the star known as Hesper, she of the pale mild eye, was looking straight into the room where lay the precious pair, and it shone through the little window at the foot of the bed. The night was sultry, a little window, summer was in the ascendant, and the upper sash was down. Remember this, the upper sash was down. And now a strange thing occurred, a very strange and mysterious thing. Just as Tom Clark and his wife had been magnetized into a sort of restless sleep from gazing at the star, an uneasy, disturbed, nervous, but dreamless sleep, as if a heavy, thick and murky cloud just floated off a stagnant marsh, there descended upon the house a pestilent, slimy mist, and it gathered over and about the roof, and it entered, rolling heavily into the chamber, coming through that little window at the foot of the bed. It was a thick, dense, iron-grayish mist, approaching blackness, only that there was a sort of turgid redness, not a positive color, but as if it had floated over the depths of hell, and caught a portion of its infernal luminosity. And it was thick and dark, and dense and very heavy, and it swept and rolled, and poured into the room in thick, voluminous masses, into the very room, and about the couch where tossed in uneasy slumber the woman and the man. And it filled the apartment, and hung like a pall about their couch, and its fetor oppressed their senses, and it made their breath come thick, and difficult, and wheezing from their lungs. It was dreadful. And their breath mingled with a strange vapor, apparently endowing it with a kind of horrid life, a sort of semi-sentience, and gave it a very peculiar and fearful movement. Orderly, systematic, gyratory, pulsing movement. The quick, sharp breath of the woman, the deep and heavy breath of the man. And it had come through the window at the foot of the bed, for the upper sash was down. Slowly, and with regular, spiracular wavy motion, with gentle undulations, like the measured roll of the calm Pacific Sea, the gentle sea on which I am sailing toward the pyramids and Mycora, 6 years old, and so pretty. Pyramids 10,000 years old, and so grand. Like the waves of that sea did the cloud begin to move gyrally around the chamber, hanging to the curtains, clinging to the walls, but as if dreading the moonlight, carefully avoiding the window through which it had come, the little window at the foot of the bed, whose upper sash was down. Soon, very soon, the cloud commenced to change the axis of its movement, and to condense into a large globe of iron-hued nebulae, and it began a contrary revolution, and it floated thus, and swam like a dreadful destiny over the unconscious sleepers on the bed, after which it moved to the western side of the room, and became nearly stationary in an angle of the wall, where for a while it stood or floated, silent, appalling, almost motionless, changeless, still. At the end of about 6 minutes it moved again, and in a very short time assumed the gross but unmistakable outline of a gigantic human form, an outline horrible, black as night, a frowning human form, cut not sharply from the vapor, but still distinctly human in its shapeness, but very imperfect, except the head, which was too frightfully complete to leave even a lingering doubt but that some black and hideous devilry was at work in that little chamber. And the head was infamous, horrible, gorgonic, and its glare was terrible, infernal, blasting, ghastly, perfectly withering in its expression, proportions, and aspect. The thing, this pestilent thing, was bearded with the semblance of a tangled mass of coarse, gray iron wire. Its hair was a serried coil of thin, long, venom-laden, poison-distilling snakes. The nose, mouth, chin and brows were ghastly, and its sunken cheeks were those of famine intensified. The face was flat and broad, its lips the lips of incarnate hate and lust combined. Its color was the greenish-blue of corpses on a summer battlefield, suffused with the angry redness of a demon's spite, while its eyes, great God, its eye, for there was but one, and that one in the very center of its forehead, between the nose and brow, was bloodshot and purple, gleaming with infernal light, and it glamoured down with more than fiendish malignance upon the woman and the man. End of chapter 2. Chapter 3 of Tom Clark and His Wife, The Rosicrucian Story by P. B. Randolph. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Double Dream, Part 2. Nothing about this thing was clearly cut or defined, except the head, its hideous, horrible head. Otherwise it was incomplete, a sort of spectral formlessness. It was unfinished, as was the awful crime thought that had brought it into being. It was on one side apparently a male, on the other it looked like a female. But, taken as a whole, it was neither man nor woman, it was neither brute nor human, but it was a monster and a ghoul, born on earth of human parents. There are many such things stalking our streets, and invisibly presiding over festal scenes, in dark cellars, by the lamp, in the cabinet and camp. And many such are daily peering down upon the white paper on the desks where sit grave and solemn ministers of state, who, for ambition's sake and greed of gold, play with an empire's destiny as children do with toys, and who, with a stroke of a pen, consign vast armies to bloody graves. Brave men, glorious hosts, kept back while victory is possible, kept back till the foeman has dug their graves just in front of his own stone walls and impenetrable ramparts, and then sent forward to glut the ground with human blood. Do you hear me, ministers of state? I mean you, you who practically regard men's lives as boys regard the minnows of a brook. I mean you who sit in high places and do murder by the wholesale, you who treat men as half-foes, half-friends, tenderly, men whose hands are gripped with the iron grip of death around the nation's throat, the nation's throat, do you hear? And the crushing out the life that God and our fathers gave it. Remember Milliken's Bend, Port Hudson, Fort Wagner, and the black heroes of the war. Noblemen, black too, but the bravest of the brave, yet treated not as heroes ought to be. Forget not Fredericksburg. and bear in mind that this Gorgon of your own creation will not quit you, day or night, not even on your dying day, when it will hiss into your ears, Father, behold, embrace me, and its slime will fall upon and choke you, as you have choked our country. And the sheeted ghosts of 600,000 heroes, slaughtered by a whim, will mournfully upbraid, and perhaps forgive you. Will the weeping widows and the countless orphans, pale, blue-cast women, pale with grief, blue with want, orphans, poor little shriveled, half-starved orphans, will they forgive you? Will your own conscience? Will the eternal God of heaven? Why did you sacrifice these 600,000 men? Why did you not put your guns and swords in the hands of 600,000 men? Men who had God's best gifts to fight for and maintain, liberty in their wives. Black men too, brawny, brave, strong-hearted, freedom-nerved, God-inspired black men. No black man yet ever sold his country. Why don't you first remove their disabilities here in the North? Why don't you bid them rise and be men? Why grudge free men the pay of other free men? The bounty, the pension, of other heroes of the same rank. Do this, let the Negro understand that you concede his manhood, and appreciate his prowess. Let him once know that you are grateful for all he does for the country, and proclaim it to the world, and black men will flock to your standard, not only from your own soil, but from every spot on earth where civilized black men exist. See yonder is a plain, miles in extent. In its center there stands an obelisk. Go, ministers of state, and plant on its top a banner, upon which shall be emblazoned this magic sentence. Freedom, personal, political, and social to the black man, and protection of his rights forever, and there will be more magnetic power in it than in 10,000 ministers, with their little whims. 10,000 fancy generals, with their petty little games, and such would be history's record when she handed you down the ages. If you would live in the sacred page, and have your names shine brightly, act, act at once, cut the cords that now bind the black man. Say to him, come as a man, not as a chattel. Come with me to the enfranchisement and victory. Let us save the nation. And the swift-winged winds will bear the sound from pole to pole, from sea to sea, and from continent, island, and floating barks, from hills, valleys, and mountains, from hut, hovel, and dismal swamps, will come a vast and fearful host, in numbers like unto the leaves of the forest, and they will gather in that plain around that obelisk, rallying round that banner. And before their victorious march rebellion will go down as brick walls before the storm of iron. And if France, or England, or Austria, or all combine against them, they too will go out of the battle, never more to enter it again. This is possible destiny. Think of it, O ministers of state. And so the fearful specter in Tom Clark's room had its origin then and there. Had been created by the morning's wicked thought, a creature fashioned by their human wills, and drawing its vitality from their life and pulses, drawing its very soul from out those two beating human hearts. Tell me not that I am painting a picture, limning the creature of a distorted fancy. I know better, you know better, we all know that just such hideous creatures, just such monstrosities, move viewless, daily, up and down the crowded streets of Santa Blarneo, up and down the streets of the Empire City and Puritanic Boston. But there are crowds of them in Pennsylvania Avenue, and they wear phantom epaulets upon their spectral shoulders. You and I know that just such and other monstrous, horrid things that creep from out a slimy sea exist all over the land, but principally in high places begotten of treason and lust of gold. Soon the lips began to move. It spoke, Father, Mother, I am yet weak. Be quick, make me strong. Feed me, I am hungry. Give me blood, hot streams, great gouts of blood. It is well. Kill, poison, die. It is well. Ha, ha, it is well. Ho, ho. And then the thing began to dissolve into a filmy mist, until at last only the weight of its presence was felt, for it floated invisibly but heavily through the room, and, except the gleam, the fiery gleam of its solitary eye, nothing else of it was discernible. 10 minutes elapsed after it had found voice and faded away, when suddenly a fleecy cloud that had for some time past obscured the sky in the direction of Hesper, shutting out her silvery smiles, broke away, and permitted her beams and those of the moon to once more enter the chamber and flood it with the sheeted silver glory. The room where still lingered the hateful thing, and where still slept the woman and the man. Simultaneously with this auspicious event there came sighing over the landscape. The musical notes of such a song as only seraphs sing came over the waste like the mystical bells that I have heard at sunset, often while sailing on the Nile. Mystical bells which thousands have heard and marveled at. Soft bells, silvery bells, church bells. Bells, however, not rung by human hands. I have often heard them chiming over Egypt's yellow, arid sands, and I believe they are rung by angel hands on the other side of time. And such a sound, only sweeter, came floating o'er the lea, and through the still air into the little chamber. Was it a call to the angels to join in prayer, midnight prayer, for the sinful souls of men? But it came. Low it was, and clear, pure it was, and full of saintly pity, like unto the dying cadence of the prayer that was prayed by the sufferer on the stony heights of Calvary. That same Calvary where I have stood within a year, midst devout lovers of their Lord, and the jeering scoffs of Mussulmans. And the music came, so sweetly, as if 'twould melt the stony heart of crime itself. And it proclaimed itself the overture of another act of the eventful drama then and there performing. And see, look there, the curtain rises. Woman, man, behold! Alas, they slumber insensibly on. Gaze steadily at that upper sash, above it, for it is down. See, the clear space is again obscured by a cloud, but this time it is one of silver, lined with burnished gold, and flecked and edged with amethyst and purple. Look again. What is that at the window? It is a visible music, a glorious sheet of silvery vapor, bright, clear, and glittering as an angel's conscience. It is a broad and glowing mantle of woven gossamer, suffused with rose bushes and sprinkled with starbeams. And it flows through the space and streams into the chamber, bathing all things in holy tremulous light, soft, sweet, balmy, and pure as the tears of virgin innocence weeping for the early dead. That light, it was just such a light as beamed from your eyes, woman, beamed from out your soul, when, after your agony, your eye first fell upon the angel you had borne, the man-child whom God gave to your heart a little while ago. Just such a light as flashed fitfully from your soul and fell upon the cradle. O Father of the strong and hopeful heart, wherein the little stranger lay, just such light as beamed from your eyes, in pride and hope and strange, deep prophecies, as you bent over her languishing form, heartfully pressing her firstborn to her dear woman's bosom, when you looked so tenderly, kindly, lovingly down through her eyes into her spirit, the true heart beating for you and it, beneath folded, contentedly folded arms. Contented, too, through all the deep anguish, such, O man, as only a woman and a mother can undergo. That light, it was like that which fell upon the babe she had given you, and the great man-wanting world, given first for its coming uses, then to him who doeth all things very well. Well, even when he taketh the best part of our souls away, and transplants the slips in his eternal and infinite gardens, across the deep dark gulfs that hide the dead. Just such a light as gleamed from her eyes and thine own, when your hearts felt calm and trustful once more, after the great, deep grief billows had rolled over them, grief for the loss of one who stayed but a little while on earth. All too coarse and rough for her, some little, cooing whinny, like mine, whose soul nestles afar off, on his breast, in the blue sky, and whose body they laid in the cold grave, there in Utica, after they, he, had let her starve, perish sadly for want of proper food and medicine, while I was on the deep, winsome Winnie, child of my soul, gone, lost, but not forever. Just such a light played in that little room as streams from angels' eyes when God takes back the hands of Azrael and Sandalphon, the beautiful angels of death and of prayer, the things you had learned to love too well, to forgetfulness of God and all true human duty. But they will give back what they took. They will give back all, more in the clear sunshine of a brighter and purer day than these earthly ones of ours. And the light streamed through and into the chamber where lay the woman and the man, and it radiated around and bathed every object in crystalline luminescence, and it carried a sadness with it, just such a sadness as we feel when parting from those who love us very well, as I felt on the day I parted from, brother of my soul, when we parted at that proud ship's side, the ocean courser, destined to bear me over the steaming seas to Egypt's hoary shrines. It bore a sadness with it like unto that which welled up from my soul, tapping the fountains of friendship and tears upon its way, in the memorable hour wherein I left the Golden Gate and began my perilous journey to the distant Orient, across the bounding seas. What an hour, that wherein our bodies move away, but leave our sorrowing souls behind. Well, a holy light, sadness-bearing light, like this now rested on the bodies of the sleeping pair. At first, this silvery radiance filled the room, and then the fleecy vapor began to condense slowly. Presently it formed into a rich and opalescent cloud column, which speedily changed into a large globe, winged, radiant and beautiful. Gradually there appeared in the center of this globe a luminous spot, momentarily intensifying its brilliance, until it became like unto a tiny sun, or as the scintilla of a rare diamond when all the lamps are brightly shining. Slowly, steadily, the change went on in this magic crystal globe, until there appeared within it the diminutive figure of a female, whose outlines became more clear as time passed on, until, at the end of a few minutes, the figure was perfect, and stood fully revealed and complete, about 18 inches high, and lovely, ah, how lovely, that figure! It was more than woman is, was all she may become, petite, but absolutely perfect in form, feature, and expression, and there was a love-glow radiating from her presence sufficiently melting to subdue the heart of sin itself, though robed in Nova Zembla's icy shroud. Her eyes, ah, her eyes, they were softer than the down upon a ring-dove's breast. Not electric, not magnetic, such are human eyes, and she was not of this earth. They were something more, and higher, they were tearful, anxious, solicitous, hopeful, tender, beaming with that snowy love which blessed immortals feel. Her hair was loose and hung in flowing waves adown her pearly neck and shoulders. Such a neck and shoulders! Polished alabaster, dashed with orange blossoms, is a very poor comparison. It would be better to say that they resembled petrified light, tinted with the morning blush of roses. Around her brow was a coronet of burnished rainbow hues, or rather the resplendent tents of polarized light. In its center was the insignia of the Supreme Temple of the Rosy Cross, a circle enclosing a triangle, a censer on one side, an anchor fouled on the other, the centerpiece being a winged globe, surmounted by the sacred trine, and based by the watchword of the order, Tri, the whole being arched with the blazon, Rosicrucia. To attempt a minute description of this peerless fay, on my part, would be madness. Her chin, her mouth, her bust, her lips. No, I am not so vain as to make the essay. I may be equal to such a task a century or two from this, but I am not equal to it now. There, then, and thus stood the crowned beauty of the night, gazing down with looks of pity upon the restless occupants of that humble couch. For during all these transactions they had been asleep. She stood there, the realization and embodiment of light, and there, directly facing her, glowered and floated the eye of that hateful, scowling, frowning thing, scowling with malignant joy upon the woman and the man. Thus stood the shadow. Thus stood the light. But soon there came a change o'er the spirit of the scene, for now an occurrence took place of a character quite as remarkable as either of those already recounted. For in a very short time after the two mysteries had assumed their relative positions, there came through the window, the same little window at the foot of the bed, the tall and stately figure of a man, a tall and regal figure. But it was light and airy, buoyant as a summer cloud pillowed on the air, the figure of a man, but not solid, for it was translucent as the pearly dew, radiant as the noontide sun, majestic as a lofty mountain when it wears a snowy crown. The royal form of a man, but evidently not a ghost or wraith, or a man of these days or of this earth, or of the ages now elapsing. He was something more than man. He was supermortal. A bright and glorious citizen of a starry land of glory, whose gates I beheld once upon a time, when Laura bade me wait. He was of a lineage we Rosicrucians wot of, and only we, a dweller in a wondrous city, afar off, real, actual, whose gates are as the finest pearl. So bright and beautiful are they. The stately figure advanced midway of the room until he occupied the center of a triangle formed by the shadowy thing, the female figure, and the bed, and then he waved his hand, in which was a staff or truncheon, winged at top and bottom, and he spake, saying, I, Otanithi, the genius of the temple, lord of the hour, and servant of the dome, am sent hither to thee, O Hesperina, preserver of the falling, and to thee, dark shadow, and to these poor blind gropers in the night and gloom. I am sent to proclaim that man ever reacheth ruin or redemption through himself alone, strengthened by love of him, self-sought, reacheth either pole of possibility as he, fairly warned, and therefore fully armed, may elect. Poor, weak man! A giant, knowing not his own tremendous power, master both of circumstance and the world, yet the veriest slave to either, weak, but only through ignorance of himself, forever and forever failing in life's great race through slenderness of purpose, through feebleness of will. Virtue is not virtue which comes not of principle within, that comes not of will and aspiration. The abstinence from wrong is not virtue which results from external pressure, fear of what the speech of people may affect. It is false, that virtue which requires bolstering or propping up, and falls when left to try its strength alone. Vice is not vice, but weakness that springs not from within, which is the effect of applied force. Real vice is that which leaves sad marks upon the soul's escutcheon, which the waters of an eternity may not lave away or wash out, and it comes of settled purpose, from within, and is the thing of will. the virtue that has never known temptation, and withstood it, counts but little in the great ledger of yet to be. True virtue is good resolve, better thinking, and action best of all. That man is but half completed whom the world has wholly made. They are never truly made who fail to make themselves. Mankind are not of the kingdom of the shadow, nor of the glorious realm of light, but are born, move along, and find their highest development in the path which is bounded on either side by those two eternal diversities, the light upon this side, the shadow upon that. The road to man and womanhood lies in the mean. Discontent on either side, happiness between. Life is a triangle, and it may be composed of sorrow, crime, misery, or aspiration, wisdom, happiness. These, O peerless Hesperina, are the lessons I am sent to teach. Thou art here to save two souls, not from loss, assailings, or assoilings from without, but from the things engendered of morbid thought, monstrous things bred in the cellars of the soul, the cesspools of the spirit, crime caverns where moral newts and toads, unsightly things and hungry, are ever devouring the flowers that spring up in the heart gardens of man. Pretty flowers, wild, but which double and enhance in beauty and aroma from cultivation and care. We are present, I to awaken the wills of yonder pair, thou to arouse a healthy purpose and a normal action, and the shadow is here to drag them to perdition. Man cannot reach heaven save by fearlessly breasting the waves of hell. Listen, thou mayst not act directly upon the woman or the man, but are at liberty to effect thy purpose through the instrumentality of dream. And thou, addressing the thing, thou grim shadow, angel of crime, monstrous offspring of man's begetting, thou who art permitted to exist, art also allowed to flourish and batten on human hearts. I may not prevent thee, dare not openly frustrate thee, for thus it is decreed. Thou must do thy work. Go, thou art free and unfettered. Do thy worst, but I forbid thee to appear as thou really art before their waking senses, lest thy horrible presence should strike them dumb or blind, or hurl will and reason from their thrones. Begone, to thy labor, foul thing, and do thy work also through the powerful instrumentality of dream. Thus spoke the genius of the order and the hour. And then, turning him toward the couch, he said yearningly, with tearful mind and outstretched arms, Mortals, hear me in thy slumber. Let thy souls, but not thy senses, hear and understand. Behold, I touch thee with this magic wand of Rosicrucia, and with it wake thy sleeping wills. Thus do I endow thee with the elements, attention, aspiration, persistence, the seeds of power, of resistless might, which will, if by thy choice, enable thee to realize a mortal fortress, capable of defying the combined assaults of all the enginery circumstance can bring to bear against thee. The citadel is will. Entrenched within it, thou art safe. But beware of turning thy assaulting power against thyself. Will, normal, ever produceth good. Abnormal, it hurls thee to the bad. Remember, wake not to the external life, but in thy slumber seize on the word I whisper in thine ears. It is a magic word, a mighty talisman, more potent than the seal of Solomon, more powerful than the Chaldean's wand, but it is potential for ill as for good. See to it, therefore, that it is wisely used. The word is, Try. As thou shalt avail thyself of its power, so be it unto thee. I now leave thee to thy fate, and the fortunes that may befall thee. Two dreams each shalt thou have this night. One of them shall be overruled by thy good, the other by thy evil genius. God help thee. Farewell. And in another instant the tall and stately figure passed through the moonlight, out upon the deep bosom of the night, and he floated, accompanied by the same soft music heard before, away off into the blue Empyrean. And he passed through the window, the little window at the foot of the bed, whose upper sash was down. End of chapter 3.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.